Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we start with a Boston Phoenix reunion. Both now at GBH, Bernstein and Kadzis break down a win for Marty Walsh, a loss for Suffolk Downs, and say, Willie Lantigua, we hardly knew ye. Then former Attorney General Scott Harshbarger joins us on a 2014 ballot question to repeal the whole casino law. Did the worm turn on gambling palaces yesterday?
Editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory, on the Boston mayor's race and whether newspaper endorsements, every paper went for John Conley, matter anymore. Then Hallmark Cards gets blasted for rewriting the lyrics to the Christmas carol, Deck the Halls, and leaving out the word gay. A new book on America's first sports superstar, a bare-knuckle brawler who hailed from Gilded Age Boston, Strong Boy John L. Sullivan. That's coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's all over, Jim.
I'm not nervous anymore. I was really anxious yesterday.
Basket case yesterday.
I'll tell you,
basket
but I've gotten case. Over it. The biggest upset out of yesterday's election results was finding out that Peter Kadzis either has access to a time travel apparatus or psychic powers, because long before John Connolly conceded to Marty Walsh, Kadzis called Walsh's win with eerie confidence and precision. Here with us to sort through yesterday's ballot box are political analysts, WGBH's Peter Kadzis and Dave Bernstein. David, of course, is also a contributing editor to Boston Magazine. Before we hear from them, let's hear from the victor. Marty Walsh explained in a speech last night why he was late for that speech, and later he talked about somebody who was there with him.
I just want to just let you know the reason why I was late is that President Obama just called me to congratulate me. And there's one other person that I want to thank, and I went to his grave today to thank him, and that's my father, John, who is with us here tonight in this hall.
Okay, that was Marty Walsh last night. I was thinking he was at the Boston Park Plaza when he spoke before a raucous crowd. So, Peter Kadzis, you called Marty Walsh the front runner repeatedly on our show, even though people had expected, certainly after the primary, that Conley was going to win this thing. Why'd you call him the front runner?
Because I live in the neighborhood with a lot of Conley support, but I saw Walsh building. Also, as I had said on your show before, his field organization is worth, 4 to 5 points. You know, whatever the poll said, add 4 to 5 points. The Conley campaign itself would add 4 points to every poll.
Don't be cowed by your former boss, David Bernstein, the Boston Phoenix. Feel free to speak your mind. So why did Walsh win this thing last night? Was it to get out the vote? What did it for this guy?
Well, it was a combination of things. Walsh came out of the preliminary, in my opinion, John Conley came out of the preliminary without a narrative to tell. He didn't take hold of the race when he had it under his control, when he was the guy on top. He just didn't come out with a narrative. That left an opening, a sort of a void, where Walsh was able to create two narratives that took hold. One was a sort of, to overstate it, sort of worker versus egghead dynamic. and the other one was this sort of barrage of endorsements that created a sense of unity, sort of Boston coming together around his campaign. So that was why, in my opinion, he sort of was able to take charge of the race over the first 4 or 5 weeks after the preliminary. Certainly, it ended up, Conley fought back, made it close. What happened in the end, what happened yesterday was we had very good turnout. Both sides got their people out to vote. And it really essentially came down to Marty Walsh being able to win in the battleground areas. And whether that was more to do with his turnout machine, was part of it, but also just that he was able to sort of close the sale that was made by the advertising, the endorsements and everything. So he was able to win in Hyde Park, in East Boston, in Roxbury and so forth, places where, you wouldn't have expected going in that he would be able to win.
And his biggest win was in Ward 18 in Mattapan, powered
That's
by
right.
the Haitian American community. And of all the Walsh in surrogates, endorsees Linda DeSignafori, the state senator from Dorchester.
First Haitian American in the legislature, is that not correct? Yeah. Oh, wait, she was the second, actually. Yeah, Marie the guy who was Tom Riley's running mate for a week was
Marie
the first.
That's right.
Marie St. Fleur. Mm-hmm. Those two ladies delivered every single precinct in Ward 18.
And by the way, I can add to that, that area had a very competitive open city council district race between Tim McCarthy and Jean-Claude Sinan. Jean-Claude Sinan is Haitian. He has been very active with Linda DeSignafori, with Marie St. Fleur in the past. They have been very active with him. They were very supportive of him, and she sort of merged the two entities. He has a lot of support down there in Mattapan, particularly among the, you know, not only the Haitian, which is a very big population down there, but beyond. And I found out actually yesterday that the Walsh campaign was doing lit drops for both, was doing lit drops for Jean-Claude Sinan, which may not make the winner, Tim McCarthy, very happy to know. But so that sort of merging really helped the identity, really helped sell. And like I said, all those things are introductions that get Walsh's foot in the door with voters. He had to make the sale still.
And one of the things, again, that's unrecognized is the power of low-wattage ethnic radio. The Haitian radio station. You know, we all talk about Twitter and Facebook, and we're all on the end of that. Well, in less affluent communities, you know, the Haitian radio station, the Creole radio station that you hear many cab drivers playing as they go around, that was incredibly powerful.
You know what I wonder? Linda DeSignafori's husband, it runs the Dorchester Reporter. Did they endorse for Walsh, the Dorchester Reporter?
They did, and they wrote a beautiful...
Because that was unusual, obviously, among newspapers. Almost everybody else in the city went for John Conley.
Well, I would look for the Dorchester Reporter to get plenty of scoops out of City Hall. Listen, I thought Bill Forey, and I should say I've written a couple of times for the Dorchester Reporter. Conley had a very measured, very powerful endorsement for Walsh that was very positive towards Conley.
Right.
Listen, the DeSignafori Bill Forey combination.
Did we make clear Bill is her husband?
I said that.
Oh, you did.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Now listen, this is how small Boston is. His father grew up one street away from me in Ward 17 mm-hmm. in Dorchester. But Dorchester is the chalice of the new Boston.
So is it fair to say that one of the headlines coming out of yesterday is, while communities of color couldn't elect a candidate of color, at least put a candidate of color in the final, that they were among the major difference makers, at least according to you two guys, on Election Day? Yes, David Bernstein?
I think that they were definitely part of that. Yeah, I think so. And, you know, it was interesting talking to a number of people yesterday in particular about that. The communities of color ended up very much split in terms of a lot of the elected officials were all with Marty Walsh, but sort of on a almost street by street basis. It was very split in a pretty amicable way, from what I could tell, from talking to people, in a way that doesn't often happen, because oftentimes, you know, it does become are you with Deval Patrick or against us, you know, and that kind of thing. You know, are you with Obama or against us, you know, and this turned out to be, you know, since it turned out to be two white guys, it was who both had endorsements of kinds from people they trusted in the communities. It was okay to be with either one.
Two thoughts there. Unlike New York, where I always mispronounce his name,
De Blasio, proud graduate of Cambridge Ringe in Latin high school, I should say.
De Blasio crushed his Republican opponent. But that's the Hatfields and the McCoys. Here in Boston, the Walshes and the Conleys are really first cousins. Mm. And
it's the Hatfields and the Hatfields.
Yeah. And it's interesting. What was the second point I was going to make?
Well,
I'm so glad somebody else does this.
While you're thinking of that,
yeah,
we've got an email from Christopher in New Hampshire wondering if Walsh would ever appoint John Conley to be
superintendent
of schools.
I don't see that happening.
Speaking
of that, you know, the word on the street, which David is much closer to than am I, and we're here with David Bernstein and Peter Kadzis, is Charlotte Goler-Ritchie heads the BRA or whatever the new incarnation is. John Barros maybe is the school superintendent. I mean, it's clear to me, and I assume to everybody, that Arroyo, Barros, and Goler-Ritchie have jobs if they want them. One, do they want them? And two, what jobs do they want, David?
Well, I think that Barros actually might be a better fit, in my opinion, for for the BRA or whatever the BRA is going to transition to. I'm not sure that's going to happen as fast as some people think. So I think there's going to be some transition time.
Because Menino's got a lot of appointees on there that are going to be there for quite some time,
correct? And
state legislation.
BRA, the change of the BRA is a big process. And frankly, as much as Walsh campaigned on it, I don't know that that's where he wants to put all of his political capital right off the bat. But I'm sure he'll work towards it. Barros might be a good fit there, or you could picture him in a number of different cabinet levels, cabinet level type positions.
Gola Ritchie's going to be part of the team too, is she not?
Yeah, what I wonder though is whether with Ritchie, whether that's going to be a position actually in the administration, or whether it might be finding a quasi public that she can run or something like that. I'm not sure exactly what the right fit for her is. Obviously, she'll have some kind of fit somewhere in there, and the same might be true of Arroyo, by the way. There might not be the right fit in the actual administration that he wants and that Walsh wants him on.
We're talking with David Bernstein and Peter Kazis, both WGBH contributors. I wonder what's going to happen in the Walsh administration. One of the big themes in this race was Walsh the union guy, Conley the school guy. A lot of money, a lot of outside union money came in to support Marty Walsh. So what does he do now? I mean, the Boston Teachers Union just endorsed him, right, on the election. Kind of. Well, they didn't like, because Marty Walsh, of course, is on the board member of the...
Can I answer your question before these guys do?
Yeah.
Anybody, as a former union president myself,
okay, here we go.
Anybody who thinks this guy is going to give away the store to unions is beyond clueless. What Marty Walsh is going to do before every public employee negotiation is sit down with the president of that union privately and quietly and say, listen, you got to be reasonable here. If you want me to be a power in office and help you when I can, you cannot come in with insane demands. You cannot go to arbitration. We need a deal that's modest and affordable. That's what's going to happen, at least for the first couple of years. And anybody who thinks otherwise, despite his shout out to organized labor last night and all the money they spent, these outside groups, a couple of million dollars, is insane.
But Jim, you have a city council who seems poised to approve a pretty generous contract right now. Just one police.
The 25.4.
So does Marty Walsh overrule the city?
Let me tell you how that could work to his benefit. First of all, the council doesn't have the guts, I think, to turn it down. Walsh can use that and say, hey, look, Menino did a bad job negotiating. These guys approved it. That buys him time with the firemen's union, who are the benefits. Now, everyone will be upset about this, and he takes it out on the teachers in the meantime. That's how I see it. This is Kissinger-esque real politic. I'm not saying, because I think Jim is right, and he has to find a way around this. And listen, the guy beat the odds. He's the mayor. He's a savvy guy. I say the teachers lose.
I step back for a second? One of the things I loved about last night, I love when anybody who wins a high office, whether it's Senate, an important mayor job, is standing up there and is basically saying, I can't believe I am standing here. I don't mean with a lack of self-confidence, but when he starts with, hey, everybody, I'm a little bit late. You know why I was late? You got it. Barack Obama called me. And then when he did the shout, he says, I know my cousin Marty, who was dancing wildly on the stage before it all started. He's not in my script, but I'm going to do a shout out. It was so clear this was, and he talked about his father. He told us on the radio yesterday about his two aunts who came over from Ireland. And he was clearly so proud when he was talking about the fact that his candidacy was a huge issue, allegedly, in Ireland, that sort of thing. Wasn't there that kind of thing last night? It's like, I'm looking around. I am the mayor-elect of the city of Boston.
Think about this. We all have children here. He was a little boy, 7 years old, when he lost his hair from chemotherapy, when he had lymphoma. He's wearing a wig to school that was made for him by these two gay hairdressers, actually, that lived I think they lived in the same triple-decker. They certainly lived near him. So imagine how that colors your childhood, that you are you have a very serious cancer. It takes a long time for you to feel better, and you go into school at 7 years old with a wig. I mean, the teasing that probably went on there and the toughness he had to develop, I mean, it speaks to who he is.
I think cold-hearted David Bernstein is out to disagree, are you?
No. I was going to agree, actually, because another journalist, I can't remember who it was, said to me early yesterday that she thought that Walsh was going to win, and that they knew that he was going to win, and the way that she could tell was because she had spent some time with him the day before, and he had entered the humbled phase.
That's great.
The thing where oh my god, I'm really going to be the mayor of Boston, you know, and like that she really picked up.
Can I tell you one funny story speaking about yesterday? I'm sitting at my desk in the afternoon trying to prepare for doing the election stuff with my colleagues at NECN, and I'm only half listening to what goes on in the newsroom, and I hear someone two desks away say, "Did you hear what the mayor said? He admitted he smoked crack."
Oh, yeah.
And I said to my, I'm sitting there saying, "This, it's one thing to be a recovering alcoholic." And of course, that was Rob Ford, the wonderful newsmaking mayor of Toronto.
We're talking with Peter Kazis and David Bernstein. I wonder what you guys think at the postmortem of what Conley did wrong. You talked a little bit about it, David, not having the narrative. But Peter Kazis is jumping out and saying, what did
Jim
John
knows what, again, as I said here, he didn't take the money.
Didn't take the money.
That $500,000 would have bought him soulful
Stand for Children.
Soulful ads that would have given his campaign an emotional core that it lacked. It would have matched. It would have matched Conley's, you know, gritty urban realism with, you know, gritty urban soul. $500,000 misspent.
Yeah, and he probably could have gotten more where that came from as well, because it was, what was the outside spending, I think?
It was like 2.5 to 1.3 or something like that. Yeah.
Okay, always so one last take thing, the money.
Before we move to what I think is an even bigger story yesterday, which was this overwhelming rejection of the casino in East Boston. David, the one thing I take issue with you, and you're probably right based on history, when you said a large turnout, I know it was 30 in the prelim, and I know it was up to 37 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
It is still, to me, so pathetic that 63% of the people sit on their hands in an election that may be the only real election for the mayor's office in 8 years, 12 years, whatever it is, after a guy held it for 20 years. So when you say that, you mean contextually, right?
Right. I mean based on you know what people were expecting coming
right,
in. And frankly,
right.
I first of all, I totally agree with you. I also I was amazed, you know, at the numbers that people were talking about going in. Because there were some people saying that it was going to be, you know, 110, 115,000, which would be the same as the prelim, you know, which you know just seems staggering to me. Like you know, you're not expecting any more to show up. You know, it's usually significantly more. You know, I think that there are a number of things that contributed to it, including, you know, we've talked on this show before about all the factors that kept the prelim from sort of grabbing hold of the city and people having trouble sort of getting their teeth into what their choice was there. And then coming out of the prelim, I think there wasn't really a stark choice. You know, there wasn't a sort
right.
of, oh, this guy's clearly on my side, this guy's clearly on that side. They're very, very similar in a lot of ways. And, you know, if you didn't really know that much about them before, you came out not really knowing that much about them, there wasn't that really clear narrative coming out of, you know, who. And then, you know, so I think that it just didn't grip people.
I agree with
people.
You. Both Walsh and Connolly said to us in the last 48 hours on this show, they both acknowledged that the primary differences were about style and leadership, the way they do leadership.
Well, there was a great statistic from someplace this morning that 141,000 voted in this election in Boston compared to 255,000, you know, that voted in last year's presidential election. So obviously people came out for the president. They did not.
Even
not
though there was
so
no
much.
Contest there. Even though
everybody
knew that their vote didn't mean anything because Barack Obama was going to win
Massachusetts.
But we live in a mass media age, and the president of the United States is everywhere.
Yeah.
And the mayor of Boston, while people like us are obsessed with it, he's not everywhere.
Well,
no,
you know,
there were actually, you know, there were people, I was talking to reporters who were in East Boston for the day covering that casino vote, and they were telling me that there were people coming up to vote, you know, for the casino vote. Who were then,
blanking
like,
the mayor's race?
Who had no idea who – they didn't know who was running for mayor.
I'll tell you, I know a number of people who blanked the mayor's race, but they went out to vote for Michelle Wu.
Yeah.
And
these
were people
who
that voted –
came in second.
Yes, who – these were
two
people –
two women, top
you know,
the ticket.
These were Bill Walczak supporters, Mike Ross supporters, who were just so invested in their candidates.
Right.
They were going to vote.
Well, you know, we were going to talk about this after casinos, but since you brought it up, it is a fairly historic day. Two women – both of color, Ayanna Pressley and Michelle Wu. Michelle Wu, newcomer. What is she, 29 years old? 28 years old. 1-2. Should we make more of this than the individuals winning? Is there a message out of this thing, Peter Kazis?
I think there's a message. And also what's interesting is the number five, the person who is poised to go on the council if Stephen Murphy should be appointed to something, which is you know, not out of the. I'm blanking again on the woman's
name. Anissa George.
Anissa George is the runner up there. I think so, because women in Boston have always played a behind the scenes role. They have stepped forward, and I got to tell you that in my neighborhood. Well, not just my neighborhood. Every woman I've met that was voting for Wu or Presley are passionate about these women in a way that few guys are passionate, you know, about.
But isn't it bigger than that when you say, I didn't get, if you're a liberal-leaning voter, which I think is almost repetitive in Boston, you didn't get a woman into the final. Of course, there's only one choice. Mm-hmm. You didn't get a person of color in the final. Here was your opportunity to basically cast your vote for what you couldn't cast the vote for in the final. So I'm not taking anything away from the individual candidacies of Presley and Wu, but that was a piece of it, David Bernstein, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm going to pretty much disagree, because what I think happened with the election in general yesterday was that we saw a city that likes to think that it is progressive, but really, really is very averse to change and does not like change.
Which is why Marty Walsh won.
I think
more of a status quo guy.
Well, look, we don't like to tear down old buildings and put up new ones. We don't even like to change street signs. You know what I mean? We don't like, you know, if a restaurant we used to go to 20 years ago changes its name, it bothers us.
That's right.
Right. You know. Hey, look, Marty Walsh, and I like Marty Walsh, and I think he won I talked about the reasons I think he won, but look, he's the most familiar thing to the guy we've had for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
He's not a brainiac. He's not, you know, conferring with Harvard academics about how to run the city. He's a, you know, the guy you come up to on the street and say, hey, this needs fixing, and
he's a neighborhood guy.
Yeah.
So
Marty was the most familiar, most comfortable. Well, look what happened on the city council, right? First of all, reelected 9 people, including Bill Linehan, who was up for, you know, major challenge by Suzanne Lee.
My good friend.
Charles Yancey.
Charles Yancey got reelected.
Big time.
Sal LaMattina got
Big
overwhelmingly
time.
Reelected despite,
yep.
you know, favoring the casino that got overwhelmingly rejected
Gio
and
Jackson.
So on and so forth. And then you had 4 openings where you had to pick someone new. And this may overstate the case, but you know, they replaced the wunderkind young superstar minority Felix Arroyo with wunderkind superstar minority Michelle Wu. They replaced the mayorally ambitious white Irish guy John Connolly with another ambitious white Irish guy Michael Flaherty, who was already there before.
And he ran for mayor against Menino, of course.
They replaced the hotshot progressive downtown Jewish guy with a downtown progressive Jewish guy in Josh Zakim. They replaced
Lenny Zakim's kid, for those who don't know.
They replaced the nuts and bolts. I concentrate on the constituent services, ordinary guy from Hyde Park, Rob Consalvo, with exactly the same kind of guy in Tim McCarthy. So,
by the way, David Bernstein has no notes in front of him. For those
very
who are saying
impressive.
This is very impressive.
Very impressive. But one thing in the woman thing, though, Ayanna Pressley, a lot of her platform is all about empowering girls, empowering women, dating violence, sexual violence. She's a very female-oriented candidate.
She's very,
so a lot of women just love that.
Well, a lot of women like that, but there's, I never would have thought I'd see the day when, you know, politics in Boston would be therapeutic, but they are. Look at Marty Walsh and the alcoholism, the fella from Charlestown.
Yeah,
you know,
Jack Kelly,
who, you know, admitted to drug use. There is a strong strain.
What kind
of
drugs?
I think smack.
Oxycontin and heroin.
And heroin, yeah.
Wow, that's the full Monty right there.
Yeah. Marty Keogh talks about it being very troubled, as a young adult.
He's a little more euphemistic. He's uptight. He's from West Roxbury. but Oprah, you know, Oprah has become, in a way, the patron saint of Boston politics. Very surprising.
And Ayanna Pressley, has talked about her own abuse that she suffered through. You know, so there is a lot of that.
Yeah.
Michelle Wu runs counter to that, too, because she appears to be this, like, superhuman being.
Tough.
You know, like, there's nothing. I've never seen her make a mistake. She's like, you know, everything she does is
when amazing. I was 28, I was learning how to boil water.
Let me tell you, it's really
can we move to the vote?
Casino.
I think is going to send shockwaves through the state. We're going to talk to Scott Harshbarger in about 10 minutes, who's the former attorney general, who's one of the leaders of the effort to repeal the whole casino law on the ballot. Number one, Peter Kadzis, and we're with Peter Kadzis and David Bernstein. Peter, starting with you, I thought there was a decent shot post the dropping of Caesars at Suffolk Downs that it was going to go down. Did you think it was going to go down by 12 points? I mean, this is borderline landslide.
I did not. And I think what none of us factored in, because we live in a sort of post-Christian society, is the role the church has played in this.
Yeah, big time.
Big
morality
time.
Was an issue. I mean,
yes. Yes, it was very big. And I'll tell
Ray
you.
Ray Flynn was over there. We were talking about this before he came down.
Stem-winding speech over the weekend against
and the
casinos.
And the Council of Churches talking about a David and Goliath fight.
Yeah. No. It was religion. Old-time religion is what defeated
And by the way, as a person who used to do ballot campaigns for a living, I did, it is unbelievably rare that a side that spends a lot more money than the other side ever loses an initiative, a ballot question, a referendum, that sort of thing. So does this have a trickle-down or trickle-up effect? Obviously, the casino thing lost in Palmer as well by only 93 votes. There's going to be a recount. But yesterday was a pretty bad day for the casino movement in Massachusetts.
But they've recouped. They're already looking to move to Revere.
Yeah, but does that, I just met Mayor Rizzo a couple of weeks ago from Revere. I was impressed. I thought he was a terrific guy. Mm-hmm. Anybody who thinks that after Caesars dropping, Suffolk getting crushed in East Boston, that all of a sudden they're going to move across the border to these 52 acres and Steve Crosby and the gaming commissioner are going to say, oh, that's a great idea. It's going to Everett or maybe to Milford, but it's not going to Revere, David, is it?
I suspect you're right. I think it's a long shot. But I don't know that the casino movement in general is going to take that much of a setback. You know, it's gotten knocked down in some places, but it's passed in others. And
well, passed in Revere yesterday. 61% said yes. 87% said yes in Everett a month or so ago.
Yeah. And you know, they'll find homes. You know, you know what it was to a large extent that vote up in East Boston was a kick out the door to Tom Menino. You know, it was Tom Menino. Tom Menino gave his word, is basically, you know, I've been working on this for 2 years. This is my thing. It's good. You know, the deal is the right deal. And they said, you know, in a way that, you know, I really can't imagine they would have rejected him, you know, a couple of years ago. And I also can't imagine him letting it go down the way he did. He did not, you know, I mean, he sent his troops out there, but he didn't have any presence. You know, he wasn't in the news backing up what
he
was doing.
Running for re-election, do you think it would have lost yesterday?
No.
Nor do I. Yeah. I think it would have been a narrow victory for the pro-casino forces. Let's move to one other I thought shocking, but I have to say, trying to be unbiased, but I can't be in this case, wonderful victory for small-D democracy. Willie Lantigua up there in Lawrence. And Adam Riley, our colleague, has been all over this campaign.
I think you're optimistic if you think this thing's all over.
Well, you know, it's funny. Someone texted me this morning and says Lantigua announced that the ballots or the polling places will be open until 6 o'clock today. I mean, he's Dan Rivera, who is a city councilor there, has allegedly eked out a couple hundred vote margin. There are all these people guarding the ballots and this kind of thing. You know, Elizabeth Warren, I found to be a fairly risk-averse both candidate and United States senator. And she takes on targets. Marjorie's written columns full of praise for taking on the banks, and I think it's pretty safe stuff. To endorse the opponent, which she did there, Rivera, is a pretty risky proposition, and she did. That helped. That made a difference there. It at least helped make a difference, didn't it?
It made a huge difference. It gave the progressives permission to do what they wanted to do. And I think it was smart of her to do it at the relatively last minute.
Why is that?
Because there's the danger of ethnic backlash. Oh, yes, Elizabeth Warren, you know.
This white woman from
Harvard Law School who's in Washington tells us what to do. And they didn't have time to recoup as a result of that. You know, I'm going to miss Lantigua if he goes because he provides so much color. I mean, the guy should go. Don't get me wrong.
Well, tell people
he's the James Michael Curley of the Latino population.
I mean, there's been state investigations. There's been federal investigations. I think he has a police honcho that had to leave his job on pay.
Kevin White, often investigated, never indicted.
Well, except his campaign manager, his former campaign manager has been indicted. His deputy police chief is now on paid leave. There are tons of investigations, all this sort of stuff.
However, he's fixed the parks. We understand that he's done a lot of good stuff.
And the roads are allegedly better, kind of thing.
Okay, so first of all, I'd also throw Nikki Tsongas into that because she also came in. And that had that also had a good effect, you know, the same way that Elizabeth Warren's, and she's sort of more local, you know, not just some Harvard woman coming in, you know. So it was a risky thing for her to do. That's real votes for her that could matter, you know, in a close election that she was potentially throwing away. The thing with William Lantigua is, you know, I tweet all the time about the Lantigua telenovela that we follow. And to me, a recount election is just the next plot line in the telenovela. And I'm fully, you know, I'm fully on board with this. I fully expect there to be some, like, you know, grainy image of somebody sneaking through a window with ballots out of his pocket or whatever. You know, I don't think this is going to end anytime soon.
Well, you know, they've got cops guarding the ballots today, correct? But you think we just had
a whole thing where, like, what was it, a security guard of his a while back got arrested, you know, that he had appointed.
That's right.
To, you know, so a cop guarding the ballot, you know, I'm sure that's perfectly fine.
Now, before you guys go, we're talking to David Bernstein and Peter Kadzis. One person who we've mentioned.
By the way, can I just say allegedly to everything that I just said?
Allegedly. Retroactively,
he's covered it. One person we've spoken almost not at all today is the outgoing mayor. And I had a moment yesterday. I don't know if I said this on the radio.
Oh,
I just said it to you. I had a moment yesterday. Well, I don't know if it was watching the returns or earlier in the day when I had this body shock where I said, oh, my God, Tom Menino is gone. Now, he's not formally gone to, what is it, January 6th or something, whatever date it is in January. But it is, looking back, Peter, and you were editing one of the great newspapers for virtually all of that, or executive editing, whatever the hell you were doing over there at the Boston Phoenix, for virtually all the Menino. What's the postmortem? I know it'll be written not quite yet, but what is the postmortem on those 20 years?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about that. I think whether there's we're seeing the end of imperial populism. That's what Menino was all about. He you know, wielded with his right hand, you know, raw power, and on the other hand, he was patting everyone on the head. So that's the best I can do at the moment. I mean, it's 20 years is a long, long time.
Is any long-serving executive of a city in American history gone out with an 84, whatever that last poll, 84% public approval? It is staggering to me.
Maybe the mayor of Mayberry, R&D, or something.
But, you know, one of the things, and listen, you got to love the mayor. He's talking about, and he felt sad about it today, being sent out to pasture. That was a line he had in the Herald.
Yeah,
and yesterday, he's teary over at the Spalding Rehab when they're opening But one thing about the mayor, and I think it's a criticism of the mayor, is that he didn't have these great people coming out of his administration. He didn't want anybody. It wasn't like Kevin White where these group of geniuses worked for him and went on to do great things in government. Menino didn't want to share that spotlight very much, and he didn't want too many critics. So I'm hoping that Marty Walsh should be a little bit more generous with people that work for him, sharing and lauding their achievements and listening to critics, because Menino kind of silenced his critics.
By the way, we're going to take a break for 1 second. This is NECN covering Marty Walsh live in Boston Common as we speak. Listen up.
About 20 minutes and he just offered some advice to me. He offered his support. He offered his staff. He set up a transition office for us, both in City Hall and across the street, so that we can continue to move forward, so we can have a nice, smooth transition from a Menino administration into a Walsh administration. And he gave me some good advice, and it was a great meeting. And we talked about a little bit about his first time coming into office as mayor of the city of Boston, and kind of gave me some ideas what to expect as mayor. And I was grateful for that meeting this morning. And then I just had a political meeting this morning as well with my staff. And what we're going to be doing is over the course of the next couple of days, we'll be announcing a transition team and the chairs of that transition team. And we'll probably be announcing it on Friday. And we might have some other information on as regarding the inauguration committee and things like that. But we're going to be making those announcements on Friday. I don't have any concrete answers on that. So I'd like to take any questions. He just basically said, you know, a lot of people are going to be coming at you. You have a lot of friends now. He said, just, you know, be careful and move forward. And, you know, he said, always keep the residents of the city of Boston number one. He said, stay connected to the residents of the city of Boston, like he has done. And that's how I work now as a state rep. And for the last 8 months, I've been out meeting a lot of residences and the people of Boston. I've enjoyed talking to them. And I look forward to going back to those places that I have been at in the campaign.
This morning, it sounded like talking about results today, like my question is. Can you talk a little bit about how you did it and how you won?
Yeah, thank you for that question. The mayor, he
the mayor certainly understands this city when it comes to politics, and he thought that the results were interesting, that certain parts of the city where you could expect certain votes to go, where he thought people were going to do better than others, he was surprised about a little bit. And he, you know, I won his area, High Park, which I was very happy about. I won East Boston. And he talked about all those different things. And he said, you know, again, he told me that that's important to go back and work the neighborhoods to let people in every neighborhood in the city understand who you are, what you're all about, make sure you're accessible, and make sure your administration is accessible.
So that's Mayor-elect Marty Walsh live, holding his first press conference as mayor-elect from Boston. Comedy's going to a formal session of the State House, I believe, at 1 o'clock. The next questioner was going to say is, did you ask Tom Menino who he voted for yesterday? Think we're ever going to know? In his, who's he writing with? Jack Beatty? Is that who?
Yes.
Do you think he's going to tell Jack Beatty if he voted for Connolly or Walsh?
I don't think that'll be in the book. I don't think so.
Doesn't that Jack will warm it out of him.
Oh yeah, Jack, but it won't be in the book. Doesn't that feel like the same as watching a Tom Menino press conference?
To a degree. It does.
He's got the Boston accent.
Yeah,
big
the Boston
time.
You know, I was hoping
from.
I just want to tell you what's going on and, you know, just let you know.
I was hoping, though, David, on that note, that we were going to hear these words, which I think were the finest of all the years. Here it is.
The car is no longer king in Boston.
One of my favorite lines when he's talking about the hubway getting kicked off. I mean, it's a great moment for Tom.
Well, the bicyclist union apparently endorsed both. They gave good luck to both Conley and Walsh.
Is that true?
They're very happy with both of them.
If I could respond to the point Margie made before.
What was the point Margie made?
You were talking about Menino.
Oh, Menino.
The downside.
Yes.
Listen, you're right. I don't argue with you. But I think whether it's Kevin White or whether it's Ray Flynn or whether it's Marty Walsh or whether it was John Hines or John Collins, mayors are a manifestation of the city. Yes, they mold it, but they're very much a reflection. Tom Menino became mayor at a time when expectations were going down, but the city was booming. And I think he represents that sort of duality, that almost schizophrenic. We're going to do okay, but let's not screw up. There's something very defensive about the Menino administration. It remains to be seen how Marty Walsh will embody the manifestation of Boston.
Hey, David Bernstein and Peter Kazis, you both have done phenomenally great work in many different venues, including WGBH during this campaign. Thanks. No, I'm serious. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Great. Good to see you both.
Being here. Okay, when we come back, we're going to keep talking about the casino and the surprise vote no in East Boston. Huge margin with Scott Harshbarger. Do yesterday's rejection of casinos in both East Boston and Palmer signify a statewide souring on the Bring the Industry to the Bay State? My conversation next, 89.7. WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Well, it looks like Lady Luck may be on the side of the casino naysayers. They hit the jackpot last night, as we mentioned. Voters in East Boston soundly rejected a proposal by the Suffolk Downs Racetrack, and voters in Palmer narrowly defeated a bid by Mohegan Sun to build a resort casino there. Joining us online for his take on what this all means in the big picture for the future of what they call gaming in Massachusetts is Massachusetts former Attorney General Scott Harshbarger. Scott is he's part of a group that's aiming to repeal the whole casino law through a 2014 ballot initiative. Scott Harshbarger, good to talk to you.
Hello, folks.
Hey.
What an evening. What a great evening.
Exactly. It was in East Boston, as many people that were against the casino pointed out, a David versus Goliath situation. I mean, tons of money were spent on the other side, yet the no casino vote prevailed big time by 12 points. So were you stunned, and what does this mean?
Well, you know, I confess, I was stunned. I thought it might be close. I mean, if we look around the state, Marge and Jim, you know, even back in Springfield in mid-July, an election scheduled deliberately to ensure no turnout. MGM only won that 54-46 after spending millions of dollars. This activism, grassroots efforts by the leaders in East Boston, in Palmer, in Western Massachusetts, and around this state has really been exciting. But this victory was really both decisive and I think really added a ton of confidence to people that the people might actually be able to defeat money, If the people can vote, they might well turn back this, what I consider to be bad economic policy, bad public policy generally, and also in a situation where all we're hearing are the promises and there are real questions about it. So this was a really sort of a doubling down on success, and it has just really inspired so many people working throughout the state. And I just thought it was terrific, Jim.
So Scott Harshbarger, for those who don't know, you have held this position since the casino issue was first being discussed on Beacon Hill. Give us the short versions of why you thought then and think now that this was a bad decision for the legislature and the governor.
Well, the first reason is in Massachusetts. All the things people are saying about the opportunities we have here that many other states don't have. We have leading-edge industries, healthcare, biotech, high-tech, higher education. We can do better, just as Bill Walczak said, Jim and Marjorie, in the campaign. In East Boston, it's a sad commentary on our public policy that the best we can offer people in tough economic times is a casino.
Yeah, but Scott Harshbarger, I know I said this to you once before. When I said, and I'm not a pro-casino person, as I think most listeners know, but I'm trying to be relatively fair from time to time. When I said almost those exact same words to Barney Frank when he was in Congress once, and he screamed at me the following, essentially, and that's what he does. He screams at people. He said, listen, okay, Jim, until you find those better jobs that you're talking about and then now Scott Harshbarger is talking about, I'll take these lesser jobs for thousands of people in my district, he meant in the Fall River area then, and then when you create those other jobs, we'll move them into that. But for now, I want them working. What's wrong with Barney's thinking?
One big problem is it doesn't happen, Jim. It doesn't happen. Look around the Mid-Atlantic states. Every state that has brought in casinos has not expanded in any other way. And they double down. These are false promises, and that's what to me years ago when I was Attorney General and got in, looked at this issue, it struck me as a major consumer protection issue first of all, and a public protection issue, because rarely if ever do people tell the total truth about this product. All we see are the economic benefits that are offered, but we never see the costs that come with it. And now we look around and we can see that the more people know about this, the more they look at the potential downsides in addition to the promises, the less they support it. And that's what's so important about what's happened here, is you can begin to see that people, as it's beginning to come to their backyards, beginning to come to their community, they're assessing the quality of life in that community. And I look further, the positive to this, the answer to Barney is, look at John Mitchell in New Bedford. Look at Joe Curtatone in Somerville. Look, in fact, in Boston and the Seaport. We can do better in Massachusetts. We don't have to go this route.
Hey, Scott, if I can just for a second, we're talking to Scott Harshbarger, former attorney general, one of the people behind a ballot question that could be, we're going to talk about if it will in a minute, be on the ballot in 2014, which would give the public the power, if it chose, to repeal the casino law. In a minute, when we're done with Scott, we're going to ask you at 877-301-8970, has the proverbial worm turned on the casino movement in the state? But Scott, briefly, let's talk about the ballot question.
Yes.
Martha Coakley, the attorney general, has the power to certify or not certify questions like you used to do. She denied certification. You guys went to court. You have the power to collect signatures to get the question on the ballot.
Right.
But the issue about as to whether or not the highest court in the state is going to allow you to go forward is still in a state of flux, correct?
Well, that's true, because we have to get the signatures to get on the ballot, so then we can have the appeal taken, because I think there really is a solid legal basis for this going on the ballot, and I believe that it will prevail. But up till now, on both in terms of the legislature, people thought it was a foregone conclusion. Once Martha didn't certify, unfortunately, people thought this could never happen. But we are getting, as you can imagine, an infusion now of interest. People, I am sure there are over 100,000 people in this state who would sign this ballot signature initiative to at least give us a chance to have the issue decided in some forum other than simply the legislature, and the people ought to speak. And that's so we do have, look, there's no question. This is always going to be a tough issue to fight, because the forces that support this, and I don't mean this at all malevolently, the casino folks, the people who believe that this is a positive thing for the state, are certainly going to resist. But what you're seeing now that I think is so reaffirming, honestly, is that the people are having a chance to speak, and they're raising real questions that, frankly, should have been discussed much more openly by the governor and the legislature last year before they passed this, in terms of this state and this state's economy. So I'm very, very hopeful that we will at least get that opportunity. And that's what repeal the casino deal.org is all about, just giving us hope to have a chance. And we saw the first chance. The chances have been coming. Last night was a great victory. And I really want to shout out here to Celeste Myers in East Boston, Kathleen Conley Norbutt in the Western Mass.
Citizen activists, we should say. Yeah.
These citizen activists have really, you know, I keep talking. This is my idea of what Common Cause should be about. Citizen engagement on issues that really matter to people and the quality of their life.
Scott Harshbarger, one last question from me about this, because you have been opposed to casinos, as we've said before, for a very long time. When Massachusetts said the voters said they wanted casinos, I would guess, and I don't know, which is why I'm asking you, that they may have wanted them, but very few people wanted them near them.
Right.
And I think that's what we're seeing, is it not?
Well, I think that's true, and I think, but it's also raising the broader questions. What you're seeing now, I think, is not only that it's not just I don't want it in my backyard, but you're beginning to get a broader argument. Why is Massachusetts going this way?
Yep.
Why is Bill Zabalczyk talk about the alternative ways we could have economic development in Massachusetts in a mayor's campaign and around the state? And I think our opportunity here is to try to short-circuit this. Look, if it passes, it passes. That's democracy.
Yep.
But let's let the people have their voices heard for whatever reason, because right now it is, in fact, I really truly believe it has been primarily money, the political establishment, the conventional wisdom that this is going to happen has been a foregone conclusion. And now people are having to stand back and think about, what do we want our culture in Massachusetts to be, and do we need this as a part of our culture? And I truly am inspired by the fact that so many grassroots leaders and citizens around the state with no money, have pulled off this. And with any luck and people's help, we may well pull off the repeal initiative and then have it on the ballot. That's all it does. It doesn't say to eliminate it. It just says it's going on the ballot and the people have a chance to vote. That's democracy.
Thanks,
Scott Harshbarger, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Appreciate it very much. And thanks for your commentary last night, James. It was excellent.
Thank you kindly, Scott.
Scott Harshbarger is the former Attorney General of Massachusetts, and he is among the people that are working to repeal the casino deal. If you want to learn more about that, go to casino.com. Meanwhile, we're going to open up the lines to you guys. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970, or bpr@wgbh.org. That's the email. What do you think about this? Do you want casinos in Massachusetts? Are you thrilled that there is some serious, meaningful resistance to bringing them to this state? 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. You know, part of this, I think, is to the timing of this. I mean, we were...
What?
Well, the recession, it began in 2007, 2008. I think there might have been a lot more...
And that was part of the way out in those days.
Yes, I think there was a lot more enthusiasm for it there. But when you hear Bill Walczyk, who ran unsuccessfully for mayor, argue this was the big part of his platform, I don't want a casino in East Boston. When you hear Scott Harshbarger,
he got crushed.
People,
I mean, for whatever it's worth.
He did get crushed, but there were 12 people in the race, and it was, you know, a broad field. I mean, and also he was, you know, a guy from Dorchester. He wasn't a guy from East Boston. But the point is, when you hear people saying now, do we have to go this route here in Massachusetts? 5 years after the recession began, it rings a little bit more. It's more persuasive.
I think that's a decent point. 877-301-8970. We'll hear from anybody for a few minutes. We'd particularly like to talk to people who were in the pro-casino element when the law passed a handful of years ago, but are now beginning to believe that having buyer's remorse. 877-301-8970. You know, and the issue, just to be clear here, it's not clear. Not only do they need to get the close to 100,000 signatures to get the question on the ballot, which is the way the law works, but secondly, I believe the Supreme Judicial Court ultimately has to rule in the favor of the Scott Harshbarger side and against the Martha Coakley side. And by the way, Coakley didn't take a position on the merits of the question. Her position was, as Attorney General, that it doesn't satisfy the constitutional mandates
unconstitutional
of Article 48 or whatever it was.
Was what she said. 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. What are you laughing at?
I'm laughing at something that I can't mention. Don't ask when someone's laughing like this. Make a motion. I can't mention what I'm laughing at. It's embarrassing.
Gosh.
Not for you. It's embarrassing for me.
Oh,
in any
really?
Case, let's go to Jason. You're in Taunton. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Jason.
Well, yeah, I actually called about the same thing before, and yeah. I'm just dying to get to you. You guys are very thorough, and you guys have a great program. I just
Thanks.
Want to say it. It's great to listen to you guys. But this is the second time you guys have had this topic, and not a single thing is mentioned about the Taunton Casino, which is approved. And Governor Patrick, where is he? He's the one that backed this thing. And every single town in Massachusetts that's had to go for a vote doesn't want a casino. But nobody mentions about the one little casino down there that is wanted.
Well, you're doing it,
yeah,
so make your case.
Tell us all about it.
Well, it was a town-wide vote, and it was approved. I know that it's all hung up in all kinds of governmental stuff or whatever. There's all kinds of reasons why it's not going through.
There's a bigger hang-up, Jason, as you're well aware, and we did discuss this with the head of the Gaming Commission, I think on Monday, Steve Crosby, is the basic sense, I think, spoken or otherwise, is in that part of the state, if the federal government grants a certain status to the Wampanoags there, they're going to get the casino, not a private developer, because under federal law, even if there are three casino licenses granted by the Gaming Commission, I don't know what the term of art is, but a certified tribe is by law allowed to create a casino with the same level of gambling games and not give a penny to the state. So I think of all the three regions, the Southeast, the West, and Eastern Massachusetts, at least up until last night, your part of the state is the most unsettled. But frankly, thanks for calling and putting it back on the table. Jason, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. We got to squeeze a couple in if we
Kevin
can.
Kevin from Brookline. Hi, Kevin. What do you think?
Hey, I think that my college friend used to live in Ledyard, Connecticut. Before Fox was, I would go with him to visit his family.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen that community before and after. And like anything, there's some cons, but it didn't destroy the area. You know, I mean, it did become rampant with crime. It didn't ruin it. And I think that we purport to be a world-class city, which we are. And I think of Montreal, you know, they've got a big and beautiful casino. It's a, you know, a gorgeous city. I don't think that it'll harm us if we do it correctly. I think that it'll only benefit us and, you know, and put us in that realm of a world-class city.
So why do you think the people in East Boston by a 56 to 44 margin apparently disagree with you?
You know, I think that bad publicity in media, and I think that they have sound worries. I mean, no one wants their community to see that, and they're worried that it'll trickle down the bad way, that it won't be done correctly, and that they'll suffer from it. And I think that, you know, and I'm all for it. I think that people should vote, but, it, you know, if I had my vote on it, I think that they're missing the vote. I think it would be a boon for Boston.
Kevin, you're from Brookline. Would you want one in Brookline?
I don't think that Brookline's the kind of community that can support it just because of space.
Forget space, Kevin. They never have a casino in Brookline. I mean, that's
no,
one of the things
not.
About
no, of course not.
This is one
but
of the things about these casinos. The places that, you know, Taunton has had some tough times. East Boston has had some tough times. My hometown, Fall River, has had some tough times. They tend to be in places that have had tough times, and many people.
I don't disagree, but I think geographically, if Brookline were an area that could support it, I don't think it would harm the community. I think that if they were to take the area in Southview, which isn't on the table, where the old channel used to be, that part of the waterfront, if they put that there, I think it would be a boon to all the communities. I really do. I mean, Brookline obviously doesn't have the space, but I don't think that if they were to take Lars Anderson Park and level it and put a casino there, it would change the flavor of that.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, I think it might
change the
level of the traffic in that area, that's for sure. And Lars Anderson is a beautiful park.
But, you know, but the reality, there. We should say that, well, so that Kevin is less unhappy about the vote, the likelihood of there being a casino in Everett or Milford is extraordinarily high. I mean, I don't think that Steve Crosby and his four commissioners,
that's had its tough times.
Right, which is a grand total of 4 miles away from East Boston, which voted 86.5% in favor. And if Mayor Rizzo and Revere has his way with Chip Tuttle from Suffolk Downs, they'll come up with another proposal. I don't think it's likely, but it's possible.
You know,
there's going to be something in Eastern Mass.
Well, this,
unless
this,
Scott Harshbarger prevails,
this certainly puts pressure on the new mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, to look out for Boston. Boston if Everett winds up getting this casino, because they're going to get the bulk of the money and Boston's going to get the bulk of the problem. So
I agree.
That's the one thing about East Boston turning this down, that the money is not going to come to Boston to the same degree.
They knew that. I mean,
I know.
Hey,
they knew that.
One last call on this. Justin, you're in Fall River, hometown of the great Marjorie Egan. Hello, Justin.
Hi, Justin.
Hi, how's it going?
Great.
Good.
Okay, so I'll just go ahead and just say that, and I'll keep it short and simple, but if you want people in Massachusetts to pass this casino bill, and again, I'm not really sure as to the legality of it, but there are a few things that are going to have to be done. One is, if it's going to be a state-run casino, then, you know, they keep bringing up Mohegan Sun as the group that's going to build and run the casinos. That's going to hurt the vote right there. The second thing is there's got to be.
Well, it depends on the deal. I mean, Obviously, Foxwoods is behind Milford. Wynn Associates, or whatever it's called, is behind Everett. So Mohegan Sun is, you know, they're
we
different.
We don't know who's going to do Suffolk Downs.
And I'm just giving you what the people in Massachusetts, what their interpretation is and what it would be, because they were pushing this out as a state-run casino.
It's not state-run. Just to be clear, it's state-licensed. They'd be privately owned and run, and they negotiate a deal with the state where they, by state law, have to turn over X percentage of their revenue, whatever the formula is. But they're private ventures that are licensed by the state, Justin.
Right, but that's not how this was marketed a year or two ago. That's not how it was marketed. So people may be now, I think now it's coming to fruition, and they're starting to look at this. Well, how did Mohegan Sun come into all this? And so that's the first thing, is how they marketed it about a year and a half ago or whatever, and now people are looking at this saying, okay, well, whatever happened to the whole state-run casino thing.
Yeah, but just to be clear, and Justin, we got to go, and thank you for the call. Just so it's clear, Mohegan Sun, at least in eastern Massachusetts, there's no Mohegan Sun involvement. There was Caesars. They dropped after the 556-page report, or whatever it was, from the investigators for the Gaming Commission. There, of course, is, as I said, Wynn, whatever they're called, Steve Wynn Entertainment in Everett. And there is Foxwoods over there. I know you're into floating chairs. In any case, Justin, thanks for your call. We're going to stay on this issue in the weeks ahead because I am obsessed with it, and I think a lot of people listening are too.
When we come back, it is time for Open Mic with the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGroy. We'll talk about Election Day and some other things with Brian. That conversation next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us on the line, as he does every Wednesday, he's 2 minutes late. We were told he was getting measured for his World Series ring. I don't know if it's true or not. For open mic is Brian McGroy. He is editor of the Boston Globe. Hey, Brian.
Funny, Jim. Very, very funny. Cute, clever.
Thank you. I knew you'd appreciate that.
Hello, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm very well, Brian McGroy. Always great to talk to you. So we have a new mayor. We just saw him on television there. He was in the mayor's office with Tom Menino and having a little chat. How come Marty Walsh won, Brian McGroy? You've been watching this politics around here for a long time.
Well, he ran a stunningly good campaign, didn't he? Back right after the preliminary election, it looked as if John Conley, his opponent, had much wider, deeper support around the city. And Marty Walsh very effectively plugged into the minority communities. He got some key endorsements. He worked it hard. He was very visible. He used his life story very, very effectively, the overcoming cancer as a child, overcoming alcoholism as a young adult, his hardscrabble upbringing in Dorchester, and it was a compelling story for a lot of people. I mean, let's be honest, there weren't a lot of thick policy proposals on the table, but what people connected with was a human being.
So you think that having the guy from the Whiff and Poofs at Yale, the singing groups, the tables down at Maury, the place the Louis dwells, whatever it is, that's the guy that ran John Conley's campaign. You think going with the Whiff and Poof was the wrong way to go?
Well, look, John Conley was actually a pretty good candidate, but he right after the preliminary election, he seemed to go dark for a period of time. I suspect he was raising money because he knew he would have to keep up with an onslaught of labor money coming in on the other side. But going dark certainly didn't help him coming out of the gates. And then, you know, for my money, he was absolutely the education candidate, but I think he needed to broaden himself out and his appeal out a little bit beyond that, and I'm not sure he did that effectively enough.
But, you know, for all the endorsements he got from other candidates who ran, Charlotte Gola-Ritchie, John Barros, Felix Serrero, the candidates of color in the Boston mayor's race, a long list of state legislators, a really, really long list of every sort of labor group in the state. Every newspaper, with I think the exception of the Dorchester Reporter, went with John Conley very eloquently outlining why editorial boards thought he should win, including the Boston Globe. So
and the Boston Herald.
And the Boston Herald, yeah. Exactly. My newspaper and the Bay State Banner, which represents a lot of the African American.
Yeah, but the Boston Globe did not say anybody but Marty Walsh in the preliminary.
No, we said anybody but Marty Walsh in the preliminary, and we endorsed John Conley again in the final. And, you know, the Bay State Banner, I said the Bay State Banner, The Sue O'Connell there at the South End News. And Bay Windows representing a lot of the gay community. So he had all these newspapers with him. We were all wrong, I guess.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you're ever wrong when you simply outline your support for somebody. You state the reasons why you support somebody and you put it out there. I question now what I've always questioned, and that is the real value of these endorsements. Newspapers matter, politicians matter, but what ultimately matters the most is how these candidates do on the trail, how they do over the course of the campaign. This shows yet again you have these campaigns for a reason, and that is it gives voters the opportunity to see the candidates over a longer stretch of time, see how they behave, see how they function, see how they connect with voters or not connect with voters. And ultimately, you know, amid a storm of endorsements, I really think it comes down to the two candidates themselves.
Did you talk to Walsh since last night?
I have not. I'll be honest with you. I don't know either of these guys.
Is that really true?
It's completely true. I've met them each probably for about half an hour. I don't know them at all, and I can't tell you that I'm sitting here saying, "Oh my God, I can't believe I don't know them." I'm in a funk because I don't. I kind of like starting from scratch here, and I think it's a very healthy thing.
Yeah, I think you can take them out to the Capitol Grill and have a lovely.
I knew you were going to come at me.
No, you thought I was going to come out with that.
Absolutely knew it.
I couldn't resist.
I think it's not the Capitol Grill now. I think if I want to have dinner, and I don't even know if they serve dinner. If I want to have dinner with Marty Walsh, we're over at McKenna's, but it's more likely lunch over there at Savin Hill.
You know, there was another great line you guys had in the Globe today that Boston hasn't had a labor leader mayor in years, and it's a rarity now in most American cities. So what does that translate into for the city of Boston, do you think?
Well, let's be clear. It's not as if Tom Menino was anti-union.
Right, and neither was Conley.
At all. Obviously Marty Walsh comes at this from a whole different place. I don't know what it means yet. I think, for him it means he's got to be thinking, for credibility's sake, does he need to take a stand against labor at some point early on? Does he wait for the occasion? Does he seek it out? I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I thought Jim O'Sullivan had a really good analysis on the front page of the Globe today, and that, you know, Marty Walsh used an army of labor supporters and a couple of million dollars at least in labor spending. But in the end, his support didn't necessarily come from labor households that pushed him over the top. It came from various communities all around Boston, some of which don't connect with labor at all. So I don't have a handle yet on what the labor involvement means here, what his history means. I think that's what makes this so fascinating playing out in the weeks, months, and years ahead.
I said earlier today, my sense is that since that's what everybody's going to be focused on, that this guy, meaning Marty Walsh, is going to sit down with the first public employee union that has a major contract negotiation privately and quietly prior to the negotiation starting and saying, hey, listen, gentlemen and ladies, we have to cut a deal. It can't be exorbitant. If it is, I have to say no, and there's going to be hell to pay. I mean, don't you think he's going to focus on disproving all of the people, including John Connolly, who said he had no independence and he was going to give away the store?
Well, that's what I meant, Jim, when I said he's got to take a stand and it's got to be early. And I'm not sure whether he seeks it out or whether he waits for it to visit him. But either way, I think it really behooves him politically to do something relatively soon in an early stage in his administration. I think you're absolutely right with that.
Have you read? Well, it's because you said it a few minutes earlier, apparently, and I missed. Hey, Brian, have you written one piece in the paper? You wrote one, have you not, since you become the editor? Am I wrong?
I've done one on Tom Menino stepping out.
Well, that's what I was just going to ask you. Are you going to write? I was thinking about you this morning. Are you going to write the final Menino piece on January 6th?
It's a good question. Probably not. Probably not.
Why'd you laugh? Obviously, I touched something.
No, I was looking at our very great design director over here, Dan Zedek, was pulling out the front page from Tom Menino's initial election back in 1993 when he was first elected. He was acting mayor. He was elected mayor for the first time, and lo and behold, my byline was on the lead story of his election. I couldn't believe I've been here a long time.
Yeah.
Made me feel very old, but it kind of brought me down memory lane a little bit about covering that mayoral election 20 years ago. There are people who could probably do this a lot better than I could here, writing the Menino retrospective, so I would probably defer to them, but it's still in the back of my mind.
Well, you know, Brian, it always annoys the rank and file when the editor, the guy that runs the whole place, bigfoots them out of the column on the legacy. You know what I'm saying, Brian?
I think I'd probably agree with that, Marjorie. I think I probably would, yes.
Yeah.
Hey, Tushar.
But before we move on from Menino, though, we talked about him earlier with David Bernstein and Peter Kazis when we were doing our analysis of the race. Menino got a little teary when he was at a dedication of a playground in his name at the Spalding Rehab Center, that beautiful little playground that he's put together really quickly. And he was also saying in the Herald this morning that he's ready to go out to pasture.
Being put out to pasture.
And you just sort of feel, wow, I mean, you do know him well, and you've interviewed him many times. What does he do now?
I think there's still a lot for him to do. And look, this is not a guy leaving public office at age 40 or whatever, 45 with a life ahead of him in which he's not sure exactly what it is he's going to do. I mean, he's of normal retirement age anyways. But even that said, I don't think he has any plans whatsoever to retire. I think that within the community, he still has a lot to say, whether he decides to say it about Boston or about other things, I don't know. But I can easily picture him landing in academia somewhere, teaching a symposium or a course or whatever, and still living a very interesting life. A lot of people in this town admire and like him very, very much. That's obvious. His approval rating is still through the roof, and I think he's got a lot left to do here.
Brian, if you don't write the legacy column or whatever the term was, you and Marty, for Menino, will you be writing the legacy column for William Lantigua? Are you considering?
Is that thing resolved yet? Or
no.
What, it was 60 votes,
no.
Right?
It was 60 votes. So the best line of the whole night, I thought, was Dan Rivera, who was the guy who at least temporarily is ahead. The city councilor said, quote, they better put a guard at the ballot, so we're going to have a problem. Even more surprising to me than Lantigua, at least temporarily, being behind in his run for reelection. Were you not surprised, at least by the margin of the vote, the no vote in East Boston on the casino?
I mean, I'll be honest, I was surprised at that. I figured that for all the money Suffolk Downs has spent over all these years, all the people they've hired over there, very, very high-priced strategists, lobbyists, communications experts, I would have thought they would have identified who it was that supported them and driven them all to the polls in Lincoln Navigators with, warm turkey sandwiches in the back seat. The fact that that wasn't done, I think a lot of people have to be doing some soul-searching today.
Yeah, well, I'm stunned too, and I think it shows the we may have wanted it in general to have gambling in Massachusetts casinos. We already have gambling in Massachusetts, of course, casinos, but you don't want them when they're going to be across the street, Boston.
There's a couple of things at play there, Marjorie. One is, yes, I agree. It's maybe the legislature wanted casino gambling, but and maybe in polls, residents say in the abstract, casino gambling is a good idea. But exactly to your point, when it comes to being in their neighborhoods, many places don't want them. Some places do. Revere, Everett, they have said they would take them. But on the whole, there's a lot of rejection out there. And keep another factor in mind here. And that is, when this passed the legislature, we were barely recovered from the throes of the worst recession in any of our lifetimes. and the unemployment rate among the trades was sky high, 40-50% in greater Boston. And we're desperate for construction jobs and jobs of any kind after the construction was completed. It's a at least slightly and probably more than slightly different situation now. There are cranes in the air all over greater Boston. There's construction going on everywhere. The unemployment rate is recovering, albeit more slowly than anybody would like, but it is recovering. And we're just not where we were when this thing passed the legislature. And I think I believe in the wisdom of crowds. And if these crowds say they don't want them, then who are we to say otherwise?
I agree with everything you say. And Marjorie said a variation on that about an hour ago. But the one amendment I'd say is the notion that the legislature wanted this. One of the great lessons in raw political power is when Sal DeMasi was the Speaker of the House, and there was a vote on casinos. It lost overwhelmingly. Look, it was something like 120 to 30 or some such thing. He obviously opposed casinos as speaker. When Bob DeLeo from Winthrop became speaker, who is a big fan of a casino, particularly at Suffolk Downs, not only did the vote reverse, I can't remember the number, Brian, but it was something like 112 of the legislators who had just voted no on the casino a year or two earlier had an epiphany and voted yes. Coincidentally, because the Speaker of the House liked that, which sort of shows their
they saw the light, Jim. Don't be so cynical. So
yeah, I'm not sure, Jim, that that's a testament to anybody's power or lack of power. I think it's a testament that the legislature, on many of these votes, in an alarming way, is a pack of lemmings who just kind of do what they're told, no?
Well, that was exactly – no, it was my point exactly.
Right,
Sal DeMasi said vote no. Bob DeLeo said vote yes, and they did what their leader told them to do. That's where I was going.
Are we moving off Lantigua?
Yeah, you can do that. Fine, we're done.
Not, we can't?
Yeah, we can.
Oh,
sure.
We are done. Because I want – Brian did write a 90-minute interview with William Lantigua.
Exclusive in 2010.
In Lawrence. And you sat down with him in his office. And he, of course, has been the subject of many investigations. There's been state investigations and federal investigations. What'd you make of this guy?
I mean, he sat down with me, so I love the guy.
And nobody else at the time, should say.
Well, you know what happened that day? I just showed up in, I don't know what I was doing. I just showed up in City Hall out there. I'd never met him. I wanted to do something. I just showed up. I never expected to get him. I knocked on his door. I asked for Mayor Lantigua. Some assistant said, you know, where are you from? I said, the Globe. They said, you're out of your mind. And he kind of came walking through. I introduced myself. He said, oh, come on in. And we sat there and we talked for, 60, 90 minutes, and he could not have been more upfront. He was very appealing, very charming guy. So I wrote a column about it at the time. I mean, look, he's got some issues out there, obviously, and they're not small issues. But this thing is a tight vote, and I worry a little bit that the other guy might have claimed victory a little too early, but we'll see where it goes.
The great line in your piece, Brian, by the way, and you know that I research all things McGrory like nobody else does.
In a scary way, Jim.
In a scary way, yes. Here is William Lantigua sitting down exclusively with Brian McGrory on February 11th, 2010. I'd be letting people down if he resigned his legislative seat, because he was both a state rep and a mayor when he was elected, not only in Lawrence, but around the world who are watching his...
Oh, we forgot to mention that, right.
People in the Dominican, people in Europe.
Two jobs.
Exactly.
Two jobs. He's the mayor and he's a state rep at the same time. I think you asked him if he should donate a part of his salary to charity, but he wasn't going there either, was he, Brian?
In that column, how far in the tank was I? I don't even remember.
I think you had to have – you had a snorkel to make sure that you were
– No scuba gear, just a snorkel.
Exactly.
That's good.
Now, Brian, I wasn't here last week. I know it was a source of great dissatisfaction.
Where were you, by the way?
I was actually giving a speech to the Mass Medical
Society.
Thank
mission.
You very much.
Why, Marjorie, why do I think he's talked about this speech about 100 times?
Yeah.
Brian, I haven't spoken to you at all, actually, on the air off since the sale was finalized to John Henry. What can you tell us about, I'm assuming, when anybody new who's creative, and obviously this guy's very creative, I read his 2,800-piece, word piece in the Globe. What kind of changes are on the immediate horizon that we'll see? Not internal stuff that will mean nothing to readers. What are we going to see in the next couple of months under a John Henry ownership?
I mean, I think that is not completely clear yet, but I think it's going to become clear. I mean, you read his op-ed essay. I thought it was terrific.
So did I actually.
I thought it was thoughtful. I thought it... It made very, very clear that this wasn't some sort of impulse buy a guy who just came to this late in life. He's been thinking about the media for many, many years. He's been thinking about the Globe specifically. He wants to make even more of a mark in Boston than he has. He understands the value of a major paper like the Globe. And I've been very, very encouraged internally. When John Henry wants to do something, he wants to do it the right way. And that, you know, may require spending money on it. That may require having patience in terms of an investment. But he's not looking to just cut his way to a quick profit. He's not looking to dismantle anything. He's looking to make an extremely positive mark in the city.
And is there anything? But is there anything you can tell us that is on the horizon that we're going to see that's going to be either moderately dramatic?
I mean, Jimmy's owned us for a week, so what are you looking for? So Monday, we had. And I know you're waiting to congratulate us on this. Monday, good. We had a new football section in the paper.
Yeah.
I thought it was pretty good.
So did I, actually.
A section called Score, which is an NFL roundup, all sorts of new features. I mean, is that a John Henry production? No, but we had that in the works prior. But the fact I know he's willing to spend money on the editorial product rather than reducing the editorial product gives me the freedom to go ahead and do stuff like that with his approval.
Okay, fine. We'll move on to one final thing. You know, when I read, I think in your paper, I'm not sure, 2 days ago, that Building 19 was closing, the first person I thought of was you, Brian. Can you share with us some of your best memories walking the aisles of a Building 19, either in Natick or whatever your favorite Building 19 store
was? Well, it wasn't in Natick. It was in Building 19, which was the original building in the Hingham Shipyard.
Don't tell me you were there.
Oh, God, yes. I grew up in Weymouth when Building 19 was still the Building 19 in the Hingham Shipyard.
It was named. I read that in the paper.
Yeah.
I used to work for a place called South Shore Lobster in the Hingham Shipyard. Honest to God.
What'd you do at South Shore Lobster?
You sold lobsters.
I would sell lobster. I would deliver them to restaurants. I would pick them up on the fish pier. I would drive around the South Shore delivering them to fish stores and restaurants. And, I would actually claw them and band them as well.
Did you get bitten?
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, how much does that hurt?
Like more than you can ever imagine.
This is painful. I was going to mock you for having never been to Building 19.
Oh, God, no. No, I trust me. I had my college dorm room was furnished via Building 19. This was an amazing story. As we said in the story, I thought we had a pretty darn good story.
You did,
about it.
Actually.
You'd walk in looking for like a fireplace poker and you'd leave in a Brioni suit. It made no sense what you did when you were there, but it was an amazing place. And their advertising was extraordinary.
By the way, Gail Huff did a piece on GBH TV last night about how she and her husband, Senator Scott Brown, essentially furnished their whole house.
Yeah.
From Building
Great
19.
Deals. So, the teak furniture sometimes unbelievably cheap. You can get it for furnish the whole back porch for like nothing.
And high quality stuff.
Yeah.
I mean,
you're talking about,
you know how you go into an outlet store now, Marjorie?
Yes.
And you're always wondering, the stuff I'm buying, was it made just for the outlet store? And, you know,
yeah.
You go into Building 19, that was legitimate salvage stuff. You know, the factory had a fire or something, or the store it was being sold had a fire. And it got shipped to Building 19 because they bought a whole lot of it. It was a great, great place.
How many back scratchers did you buy there, Brian?
There's a good joke about that, Jim, that I'm going to hold back on.
Oh, please.
Okay.
Hey, Brian McGrory, it's a pleasure as
Thank
always.
You.
Thanks. Good to talk to you.
I was also more of an Ocean State job lot person myself.
He sold lobsters.
He sold lobsters. That's right.
And
he was
lobster.
Bitten by them. Brian McGrory, thank you for being with us
Thanks,
as always. Brian joins us every Wednesday at 1 o'clock for Open Mic. When we come back, we're going to ask you, when does a huge effort to be politically correct actually strain normal social conventions? Why people are saying return to sender with Hallmark Card's latest holiday novelty. That's next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
the halls with boughs of holly. Fa la 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 la. Tis the season to be jolly.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. No, we're not jumping the gun. Just stay patient. One consequence, though, of rushing the season is that retailers have more opportunities to alienate shoppers. So far, I think you'd agree, Hallmark takes the prize. They have apologized for changing a word in that well-known Christmas carol you just heard. This is unbelievable. From gay to fun on a holiday ornament. What happened, if you haven't read about it, Hallmark created an ornament for its keepsake line. It's a miniature sweater bearing the words, "Don we now our fun apparel." Instead of the famous lyric we all grew up with, "Don we now our gay apparel," from the Christmas Carol Deck the Halls. So how did this stab at political correctness go so wrong? Is this seriously tone deaf when you look at the progress in the gay rights movements in the last decade? And speaking of progress, Marjorie, what is the state of gay rights in all 50 states in 2013? You know, our number is 877-301-8970. First, what's your reaction to this Hallmark thing? Some people are boycotting Hallmark, even though they have apologized. They originally defended their position. I'll read you that in a minute. Then they apologized. But, you know, my immediate reaction was, are they kidding? What kind of meeting was there? But then you say to yourself, well, Illinois, we learned yesterday, is about to become the 15th state plus D.C. with gay marriage. In Washington, we have John Boehner saying that the House will not even vote on a Senate-passed bill that would ban discrimination against gays and lesbians in the workplace.
Well,
so the bottom line,
John
is we've come a far...
Boehner is once again in the, being held hostage by the Tea Party in his fear of losing his job.
30-plus states have constitutional amendments banning gay marriage. So while the progress has been immense, and when you read a story like the Hallmark story, you say to yourself, they have got to be kidding. The reality is, it's even though polls show, for example, what, 56% of the people now support gay marriage, it is not still, it's more mainstream, gay rights, gay tolerance, all that sort of thing. It's not nearly, as evidenced by Hallmark, as mainstream as most of us, you and me included, think
Hallmark,
it is.
I don't know what they were thinking of. Pick a different song. You know, do your little sweater on Joy to the World or some other Christmas carol that gets a sweater in there or a coat in there or a hat in there or something. I mean, they're just insane. But, you know, there was a great piece. I mentioned this to you yesterday, Jim, in Salon, talking about Joel Osteen. He's one of those big evangelical church leaders. And they're talking about how evangelicals have realized that they got a problem. Their anti-gay position, and it's in mainstream Christianity, has just fallen out of favor with the public among their younger people in church. It's the same thing as younger people in general. They say, enough of this gay bashing stuff. Then you have the Pope. I mean, the Catholic Church has for years, I mean, said very nice things about the gay community. And now you have the Pope saying, who am I to judge? If someone seeks the Lord, who am I to judge? Now he's seeking questionnaires from Catholics. I mean, the Catholics in the parishes have all these, mothers of gay parents, fathers of gay kids, you know, all these welcoming thing for gay people. So when the Pope and the evangelicals are saying, wait a minute, we have to reassess our position here, you know that the times they are changing. Our number is 877-301-8970. I think it's over. I have thought it's been over
for
a while.
The train is leaving the station.
It has long left the station. And you may have some of the more conservative states, the so-called Bible Belt, holding out for longer. But I think it's just done.
How about Hallmark?
Well, I think Hallmark's
initial position, by the way, they justified their initial position before they apologized by saying, quote, the word gay meant the sweater's lyrics, Don We Now Our Fun Apparel, would be, quote, open to misinterpretation. Major corporations, I wish our friend Nancy Kane was here from Harvard Business School right now. These are not people who decide things on the fly. Some people sat down in a room and said the bulk of the purchasers of this little sweater ornament are going to be upset if it says Don We Now Our Gay Apparel. So there still is a significant piece of the population, or at least a significant piece of some part of the population, that is not quite aware that the train is leaving the station.
Well, I think it's a shrinking part of the population.
I think you're right.
And it's just, who's been the big opposition to this? Religion, right?
Yeah.
That's been the big opposition to
this. Some religion.
Yeah, well, I mean, mainstream Christianity and Catholics and Muslims aren't that keen on gays either. So, I mean, it's been religion. And I think when you see the people in the religious community changing your mind, you think it's not going to be long before. And also, we've said this a million times before, when you look at polls, the age gap is just huge. older people, you know, people that are 50 and, old, and over, maybe a little bit more skittish about the whole thing. If you talk to somebody who's 20 years old in Massachusetts, they think, what are you talking about?
Well, so and it's even across the country, 18 to 29, exactly, like 80%.
Exactly. And that was the point of this piece in Salon about the evangelicals, that the younger evangelicals, they may be completely on board with their church on 90% of things, but they are not on board with their church on gay rights whatsoever.
Can I tell you one thing before you give the number? I think the Hallmark thing is a great thing. And the reason why, because I think most people recoil at this and say, how preposterous is it? And I think it causes people to say, well, wait a second, why do we continue to fight over this? And you know what's amazing? I don't know, who did I say this to? John King the other day when we were talking about this? The fact that a significant piece of the Republican Party has gotten it on immigration, and that's why I think despite the chaos in Washington, there will be immigration reform maybe in 2014. I know it's a midterm election year. The reality is the bulk of the Republican Party is going to get this eventually and say it's not worth losing elections over an issue like this. And then ultimately the train will have formally left the station. But when you see things like Hallmark, you say to yourself, obviously, we're not as far along as you think we are.
No, we're not as far along as we are. But remember, just it wasn't even that long ago when the late Jerry Falwell was worrying about which one of the Teletubbies was gay because the little Teletubby was carrying, the one that carried a purple pocketbook or something was supposed to be.
That's what I thought too.
I mean, he would say that today, and he would be absolutely laughed out of town.
So do you stop buying Hallmark products, Marjorie?
I must admit, Jim, I have not bought a Hallmark product in quite some time.
You know, you should consider buying one so you can stop. Let's take some calls at 877-301-8971. What's your reaction to this Hallmark thing? But much more importantly, where do you think things are in 2013, in November of 2013, on gay tolerance, gay rights, gay acceptance, all that sort of thing? Let's go to David. You're in a traffic jam somewhere. We apologize for that. Welcome.
I'm kind of unexpected. I'm on bottom 495. I'm driving down from Maine to visit my daughter in Greenfield, Massachusetts, and we've had come upon this issue in our state now with the our present governor is going to be running next year against Mike Michaud, the our representative, who is many as probably you know has declared that he's gay, there was some business about whispering and, you know, dirty tricks, talking about him. And, you know, he just came out, and I just wanted to say I thought he was brave of him to do that. But also, as I mentioned before, that it is politically savvy. You know, he didn't talk about, you know, the timing was good.
Well, let's say, you know, speaking of Mike Michaud, here he is. He wrote an op-ed in the Bangor Daily News on Monday. Here's what he said.
Yes.
They want people to question whether I'm gay. Allow me to save the trouble with a simple, honest answer. Yes, I am.
Right.
But why should it matter? And here he is immediately after that on CNN.
I'm Mike. I'm the same Mike today as I was last week, a year ago, 3 years ago, 15 years ago. I haven't changed a bit.
Now, what's the reaction? Your governor, was it? Is it Paul LePage? What's his first name? Paul, is that his first name?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
What's his very conservative Republican, a Tea Party favorite? What reaction, if any, is LePage had to Michaud's pronouncements of earlier this week?
None at all.
That's a pretty good thing, is it not?
Yeah.
And what do you think, David, about the citizenry up there in Maine? Do you think this is going to factor into their vote or not?
What
do the voters think up in Maine? Do you have a sense of where people, how people are reacting to this?
Well, Mike Michaud is probably the most popular, politician in the state of Maine. He's a son of a third generation paper, worker, and he's just been serving people pretty consistently for a long time. So.
Well, David,
he has a good chance. He's got a real good chance.
David,
there's a three-way race, so it's kind of dicey.
Yeah.
We're glad you brought it up. Michaud is a Democrat, for those who don't know. David, thank you for the call. And we should mention, I assume everybody knows this, I don't think there's ever been a race for a major office in American history where there were two more pro-gay, lesbian, bi, and transgender candidates than Connolly and Walsh. They were both, Bay Windows endorsed with Sue O'Connell, endorsed John Connolly, and obviously Arlene Isaacson, who's led many of the gay rights struggles in these states. They're both on my show last night. Arlene Isaacson gave a huge embrace to Marty Walsh, and they were both fearless on these issues.
And Tom Menino, who's 70 years old, has been...
Sue said the best ever. Best mayor ever in this country on these issues.
On gay rights stuff. And, you know, credit to him because he's not 30. He's not 40 like the two guys who ran for mayor. And he was on board early on. And I think Marty Walsh took a lot of credit for coming out in favor of gay rights. He's the son of Irish immigrants. He's a Catholic. He was early on board for gay rights up at the state legislature, which is not that easy for him coming from a district, Dorchester, at the time when, you know, it wasn't – the acceptance level wasn't where it is now.
Well, Arlene said, and I'll paraphrase what Arlene Isaacson said, who I think is the chair of the Mass Gay and Lesbian – it was a political caucus. I hope I got the name right. She said, you know, when you have to go to church on Sunday and your parish priest is going to be railing against your vote on Beacon Hill with all your constituents sitting around them, it's pretty tough. And that's what that's the vote that Walsh took.
Let's go to Ryan in Newton. What do you think, Ryan?
Hey, how you doing?
Hey.
I want to start by saying I'm 22 years old, so I'm in that category of millennials.
Yep.
And I always think that millennials get a lot of kind of, you know, tension and aggression against them for being lazy or apathetic. But I want to remind the world that gay rights is now not a problem for a lot of people my age.
Yeah.
Being gay is completely acceptable nowadays for the most part. There's not any bullying that I've heard of in a while. It's just acceptable. And that kind of acceptance, gay has often been compared to racism. You know, it's often been compared to kind of the same way that we see it. We exclude people for being a certain way and
yep.
can't help it. It's just who they are. But I think we're really seeing the social evolution kind of take hold when we see kids nowadays realizing that it's completely okay to be whoever you are. And I think that message should be encouraged.
Well, I think that is. And by the way, it's going to be the millennials who encourage that message, as Marjorie and I said before. The percentage of your people in your age group is over practically unanimous in their support of full panoply, as there should be, of gay rights. So the
yeah.
reality is, by the time you're 40, it is over. Whether Marjorie's right or not about the train leaving the station, whether it's court decisions in those 30-plus states or whatever has to happen, the Supreme Court changing, the battle is nearing an end. Ryan, thanks for a great call.
You know, one of the reasons I was very excited about Richard Tesei, who's an openly gay Republican running for Congress last year, is I thought it would
against
be—
Against John Tierney.
Against John Tierney. And, of course, he lost to Tierney, a longtime Democratic congressman from the North Shore. But I wanted that image of Richard Tesei, a out gay guy in these conferences down there in Washington with these absolutely homophobic congressmen and see them say the things that they say about gay people with Richard Tesei sitting in the room.
Well,
great.
You know, beyond that, what did we learn? And I know this is an overbroad generalization, if that's not redundant. What did we learn about some of the most virulently anti-gay members of Congress in the last couple of decades? What ultimately was the end of many of those stories?
Well, there was a reason they were so virulent because they had histories themselves.
They were gay. I mean, a significant number of them were gay, and I agree. That would have been a tremendous – whether you supported Tesei or not, whether you supported Tierney or not, I think that would have been – it had Tesei won. It would have been a wonderful consequence of his victory.
Let's go to Michael in East Boston, where the vote took place on the casino last night. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Great,
great show.
Thanks.
I just wanted to make the point about the word gay. Most of the country western songs, when they want to express a state of happiness before about 1975, use the word gay.
Yeah.
But you can rhyme almost anything with it. And the most famous example would be Jambalaya by Hank Williams. Pick guitar, fill fruit jar, and be gay, son of a gun.
Oh, that.
We'll have good fun on the bio.
Well, obviously, that's got to change. If Hallmark was writing those lyrics.
So, Michael, I assume the gay lyrics just stay, right?
So, yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think? They're going to change the word to funno or something?
I don't know. I'm not a country music expert.
Hey, Michael, thanks for the recollection. We appreciate it.
I know.
But again, what's that?
I know you are a country music expert.
You know, I have to say, I'm not. No, I would acknowledge it's one area where I don't have a great level of expertise, but I would say I like country music. You know why? Because I like storytelling. You love storytelling, too.
Oh, I love it.
And even though there is sort of a common thread that goes through virtually every country.
The marriage is busted up. They've had 279 beers. The kids are hitting each other. I mean,
you left out the pickup truck.
The pickup truck.
I know
sorry.
It's stereotypical, but I love
the gun
that
rack
thing.
On the back. Yeah,
exactly.
I love to hear about those disasters. It's great. Jan from Groton. What do you think, Jan? Jane. I'm sorry.
Hi, Jane
from Groton.
Yes, I love your show. Love
Thanks.
Both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm so pro gay rights. I have so many gay friends. Always have. I'm 68 years old, but I have to say, Hallmark, just why even do this?
Exactly.
Do another ornament, for goodness sakes. It is preposterous that they would pull it, but You're not going to change some people's minds, and why even make a big fuss over it?
You know, Jane, I'm so glad you called, because we were talking about this upstairs. One of our coworkers, and I'm embarrassed to say, I can't remember who it was who said it, said, rather than doing this insane, offensive, Don We Now Our Fun apparel, why not decide not to do the ornament at all? Which I guess is your point. If you're so uptight about it, then don't do it, which is, I'm so glad you called, Jane. And by the way, so we have a 68-year-old and a 22-year-old who are in the exact same place. Jane, thanks for the call.
Hallmark should have stuck to Jingle Bells or something, that they could not get into this big controversy over Don We Now Our Gay apparel. But okay, enough about that. When we come back, we're going to jump into the ring with a look at one of Boston's first famous athletes, the life and times of heavyweight boxer John Sullivan. A great book about him. We're going to talk about it next on 89.7 WGBH. Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. You know, long before there was Boston's Strong Marjorie, there was Boston's Strong Boy. And that, of course, was boxer John L. Sullivan. He's the subject of writer Christopher Klein's new book entitled Strong Boy, The Life and Times of John L. Sullivan, America's First Sports Hero. Chris Klein, good to see you again.
Good to see you guys.
By the way, if you recognize the name, he was our beard expert
a
handful of days ago. He's obviously has a diverse portfolio.
So, Chris, reading about your book this morning, John L. Sullivan was not just a sports hero, but he was like this mega superstar, a man of huge appetites with an incredible story. So introduce people who don't know about John L. Sullivan, the bare-knuckle brawler.
Well, he really is Babe Ruth 40 years before Babe Ruth. They really were very similar characters. And he was the heavyweight champion of the world, born in the South End, and he was the title holder from 1882 to 1892. Went the whole decade without losing to any fighter. And he's the first athlete to earn $1 million. He comes along at a time.
That's when $1 million meant something.
Really?
Too.
And then he dropped $500,000 on booze. So,
is that really true?
Yeah. Yeah. So
well, that's one of the things you talk about. Huge, big womanizer, big appetites, a lot of eating, a lot of drinking, a lot of challenging everybody to fight. So let's start, though. Start when he was just a young guy. Tell us about how he came. He started at 19 fighting, right?
Yeah. He grows up in the South End and Roxbury. And, you know, he does various manual labor jobs, which he has a tendency to lose because he gets into scraps with his bosses and knocks them out. And then one day he goes to the Dudley Street Opera House where they're having a vaudeville routine, and there's a boxer on stage who challenges someone in the audience to come up. And Sullivan basically takes the bait. The guy sucker punches him, and Sullivan hits him with a right that sends him into the orchestra pit. And along with three violins, he was the victim of John L. Sullivan, and he basically goes on from there to start fighting in the Boston area and becomes, locally known, and then works his way up and eventually gets a shot at the title holder in 1882.
Now, did he have anything unusual? You hear about a lot of these great fighters, they have an unbelievably long reach, or they're like, you know, built like a refrigerator. What were the physical things that enabled, or was he just have a bad temper and he was fighting a lot when he was 12?
Yeah, I mean, what we think of as fighters these days, he wasn't that big. He's about 5'10", 180 pounds when he was really at his ideal weight. But he just had this intensity to him that when he got in the ring, they said, you know, the fiercest thing about him that you would just notice were his eyes, and that he would beat half the men just by staring at him. And he just had this energy that and a really big right hand that basically would knock these guys right out.
Speaking of hand, I mean, for those who don't know, my understanding is he was a bare knuckle fighter for most of his career. I think ultimately you can tell us a minute he put on gloves. But so these guys would fight with bare knuckles, and my understanding also is they fought until one of them was knocked out, essentially. It didn't matter how many rounds it took. There wasn't like a 12-round championship or a 15-round championship. They fought till the other guy couldn't get up anymore, right?
Right. Like Sullivan he's known as this bare-knuckle boxer, but most of his fights actually were with gloves.
Oh,
but
I didn't
this
know
is
that.
A, this is at a time when the rules are in transition. So when he starts, there's these the rules are called the London Prize Ring rules, and you are fighting with bare fists. You can wrestle. You can certainly get some hair pulling and eye gouging in there against your opponent. And rounds would last until someone would hit the ground, so they weren't these three-minute time rounds. But they would go on until someone basically would just drop out and couldn't go on any longer.
Who's Jake Kilrain? We're going to play in a minute a recreation of this 1889 fight between Kilrain and John L. Sullivan. Who was Kilrain? How big a deal was he?
Kilrain was, you know, the you know maybe Frazier to Sullivan's Ali. Mm-hmm. He's a Somerville guy, another big bare-knuckle boxer. And he was going around claiming that he was the true champion of the world. So these guys basically stalked each other for 2 years until they finally came together in 1889.
So was Greater Boston the epicenter of boxing at this time? You've got John L. Sullivan, as you said, from South Boston, Roxbury, and you've got this Kilrain character from Somerville. Were these just two great local fighters, or was this where the action was happening?
Boston, New York, Chicago. At this time, fighting really is ruled by the Irish immigrants. You even have fighters who were Jewish changing their names to Irish surnames as their
really?
Fight names just to try to fit
was
in.
Was it illegal? Was boxing
yes,
illegal?
Yes, it is.
The whole time?
It is technically illegal at this time, but there's always this wink-wink thing going on with the authorities.
Listen to this. Here's this recreation, I promise you. 1889, fight between Jake Kilrain and John L. Sullivan. Listen.
Middle of the Mississippi woods. Temperature 100 degrees. The roughneck crowd didn't have to pay. All the money to be made on the fight was in the $10,000 side bet between Sullivan and Kilrain. By the way, they are not fighting on canvas, but on good old American dirt. 75th round. 2 hours and 16 minutes after it began, the savage fighting ends under the broiling Mississippi sun. Jake Kilrain lies on the ground, too battered to rise. It will be the last championship fight fought with bare knuckles.
Wow.
That's exactly my
okay,
reaction.
At the end of 75 rounds, yeah. 2 hours plus in the blistering sun, what kind of shape were these guys in? Were they bleeding profusely?
Kilrain was in pretty rough shape. He's bleeding. What's even worse is his skin's just completely sun blistered because it's a 100-degree July day in Mississippi. It's so hot that the pine pitch is bubbling up from the seats that they have in the makeshift ring that they're fighting in. So,
you know,
yeah,
what
the
sunscreen
just
then.
To put this in context for those who are not boxing fans, and I was a huge boxing fan during the Ali era, like so many people were. A championship fight is either 12 rounds of 3 minutes or 15 rounds. So it's either 36 minutes of fighting or 45 minutes of fighting. This was 2 hours and 16 minutes of bare-knuckled fighting in 100-degree weather. It's unbelievable.
You know, before I get to the Irish part, which I want to get to in a second, you know, we all talk about concussions now. That's the big thing. Mm-hmm. You know, how old was Sullivan when he died?
58.
I know he
59.
Died. I know he died broke, but did he die compos mentis?
No, what's really strange when you look at these bare-knuckled fighters is that their faces aren't really banged up like you see, you know, with modern-day fighters.
How's that possible?
Because the gloves, I bet.
You just don't hit them as hard. The gloves are really more to protect your hands more than to cushion the blows. So in a way, these guys, you know, it was in some respects a safer sport. You know, it's like when they talk about football that maybe you actually were better off not having the helmets on.
Yeah.
Because you just sort of ease back a little bit in terms of in what you hit them. Now, what got these guys with the drinking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, before we get to the drinking, though, I just want to put this in context. This is the Gilded Age. This is, you know, the potato famine that happened in Ireland, and many Irish immigrants that came here, and that was the Irish Need Not Apply deal. Of course, he's Sullivan. He's Irish, obviously, from the South End, Roxbury. So how big of a deal was he in the Irish community in Boston? He just must have been through the roof.
He's a huge deal because not only you have this whole generation that came to Boston where – you know, they have the great hunger gnawing at them back in the homeland. They were repressed by the British for hundreds of years, and they come to Boston, and they're still under the thumb of the Brahmins.
Yep.
And he, you know, so Sullivan's really from this next generation on that came into Boston. You know, he's there at the time when the Irish are starting to rise in politics. You know, he's born in the South End. He's not born in Ireland. You know, he thinks of himself more as an American than an Irish American. But here's a guy who literally embodies then the spirit of the fighting Irish. He's the most powerful man in the world, and he's got Irish blood in him. So he's a huge deal, not only for the Irish, you know, here in Boston, but the Irish all over the country.
So, were the parish priests, were the parish priests, Father O'Malley, back in the back of the pews, were they like betting and cheering this guy on?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
So, absolutely. When you said he was the biggest name, in the world. I just 1882 to 1892. Is that when he was the champion? No Facebook and Twitter then, was there?
I don't believe so.
Okay, so did people actually know? Did the average sports fan? Did the average person in Detroit? Or in California. Did they know who John L. Sullivan was?
Yeah, you did.
Why? Not. Why? How did that? How?
Because he's there at this birth of the celebrity culture in America. So this is a time when newspapers are starting to come of age. And he's such a colorful personality. He's, you know, excels in the ring. Outside the ring, he's constantly getting into these, you know, having these drunken binges. You know, he's got a lot of gossip surrounding him. So he becomes very known that way. But what really makes him is that this is a time now that railroads are connecting everyone together. Mm. He's a real showman. He travels around the country in 1883 and 1884 for 8 months and challenges anyone in the country to last four rounds with him in the ring. Not to knock him out, not to win the fight, just to stand up, and they get $250. He never paid out. So
how many of those did he have? That is fabulous.
He did that. They had about 100 dates across the country. He maybe did this a couple dozen times.
So some local fool who thought he might be able to pick up $250
Absolutely.
And obviously none of them.
And to go in the ring. And so, you know, probably him and Buffalo Bill are the two guys that people in America were able to actually see in person. You know, the president never left Washington back in those days. But here's the guy, one of the most famous men in the world, and you could actually go see him, you know, in person.
So after he stopped fighting, he did some other things. He opened a sports bar and he ran for office. How did those ventures go?
Not too well. He would bounce from bar to bar in terms of his ownership. He flirted with running for the mayor, as mayor of Boston, after the mayor supposedly refused to shake his hand. So then he thought he'd throw his hat into the ring.
Why would the mayor refuse to shake his hand?
This was an old time Yankee, Josiah Quincy. So, you know, Sullivan thought he was getting snubbed by another Brahmin. But he also then he starred in theatrical productions, traveled around the country doing vaudeville. He'd star as just pitching in baseball games. He did these living statuaries where he would put white powder all over him and sort of pose as the Greek gods and all these different ventures that he got into. But, you know, what really ended up coming to derail him is he couldn't really keep a job for that long because of just the boozing that he was into.
By the way, for those who've never seen him, on the cover of your book, Strong Boy, The Life and Times of John L. Sullivan, America's First Sports Hero, written by Christopher Klein, who's in the studio with, he is one good-looking guy. I mean, he is a fine-looking man.
Yeah. In his early days. And then if you see pictures of him after he leaves the ring, and he's only 33 when he's no longer champ, but it's like he ages overnight. And if you see these photos of him where he gets up to about 300 pounds, it really – he is a spitting image of Wilford Brimley. It is
I don't really – I hope that I'm mixing my history, but was he – Gentleman Jim Corbett, was that
– Corbett is the man who knocks him out in 1892 to take his title.
And does that end his career or does he continue to fight? Why did he end at 33?
He actually does continue to fight, but in these exhibitions around the country. You know, he was pretty savvy. I mean, I think he realized that, you know – his time was done, and he flirted every once in a while about coming back. And in 1905, you know, this is, you know, two decades, you know, he's in his 40s, and he actually knocks a guy out in the third round, and it's front page news on the Boston Globe, and there's talk about him coming back. Yeah, but it's sort of just last thunderbolt. But I think he was pretty savvy to know that he really couldn't hang with these guys, and he was much too into you know, his lifestyle and didn't want to do the training.
Now, I read where he married the second wife that supposedly was trying to keep him on the straight and narrow. Did she succeed at all?
She did. He actually has this epiphany in 1905, and I think this is one of the strangest mysteries of his life, is that he tells a story that he was in a hotel in Terre Haute, Indiana. He figures in his head that he spent $500,000 of his money on booze, and then he gives it up overnight. And now, he tried this many, many times during his life, but this time it actually takes. And so, yeah, he
is that because he had a thing with Carrie Nation on the side, or what was going on there?
Carrie Nation actually did come after him one time with a battle axe.
Is that really true?
Yeah, she did stop by his saloon in New York, and it said that he would not come down to see her, and the messenger claimed that he was asleep upstairs. But as Carrie Nation goes away in the carriage, supposedly the curtain upstairs pulls back and Sullivan's face is seeing her.
Oh,
hey,
man.
Christopher Klein, we only have a minute left. I always wonder when I see a piece of work like this and I look at you, who I don't know. I've only talked to you once. Now I've met you once. Why do you decide to spend a significant chunk of your life learning and writing about a man you never knew?
Well, I think he's just he's a fascinating figure, and I came across him in other projects that I've done, but I think he's a seminal figure too, not necessarily appreciated. America's such a sports-crazy nation. It's really our secular faith, and he's not just among our pantheon of sporting gods. He really is our Zeus. This is really where our obsession with sports starts, our celebrity culture starts. And I was really intrigued, you know, being an Irish-American, by the Irish-American aspect of his story as well, and being a Boston guy. So all those elements really were ones that pulled me into his story.
You mentioned, before we go, you mentioned that a bunch of many Jewish fighters decided to adopt Irish names so they could be – who was the most famous Jewish
fighter? Irish lad, Jack Burke.
The Irish lad, Jack Burke.
He's the Irish lad.
What was he before he was Jack Burke?
I do not know that.
Okay. Who was the Jewish guy that got in the fight with the Cinderella story fellow? Do you remember that? Remember
that? No.
The guy? Yeah, he got in a fight with the guy with Cinderella.
Oh, the movie you're talking
about. The movie that was a true story, but it was a true story about an Irish fighter that...
There's got to be a movie. We only have 15 seconds. Is there a movie in this?
I haven't heard from Mad Ben yet, but you know, if you're listening in,
I think so. I think there is a movie in this.
Hey, they're Cambridge kids. I'll see what I can do for you, Christopher. Good.
Christopher Klein, thank you for being with us. Christopher Klein is an author and freelance writer specializing in history and travel. His latest book, and it's a terrific book, Strong Boy, The Life and Times of John L. Sullivan, America's First Sports Hero. Okay, thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. We're going to have Ray Flynn with us, the former mayor of Boston. We'll talk to him about the Pope polling Catholics, embracing gays. We'll talk about casinos, what happened in East Boston. Ray Flynn was very active against those casinos. And we'll go over his to-do list for the next mayor of Boston. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio.